Well, good morning to everyone. It's good to be back with you this morning. I hope you had a good evening last night and slept well. I'm going to go ahead and just jump right on in for our sake of time. We've got a good deal to cover this morning. And I thought that was feedback there for a second, and I realized it was a lawnmower there. I thought, is that me? Because it was the first church where I pastored, we did not have the greatest sound system. And if I would get too close to one of the speakers, it would feed back, and I'd see everybody do this. And it's like, you know, they're not stuffing up their ears because I'm preaching the truth, and they don't want to hear it. It's the feedback. And so I'm always kind of paranoid when I hear noises that come out of the speakers or close to the speakers. All right, so if you're just joining us today, let me share with you where we were last night, and then I will lead us into session three today. So last night we looked at migration in the Bible and did a very, very quick 35,000 foot flyover, Genesis to Revelation, looking at the fact that in God's mission to redeem individuals and to restore the broken creation, the issue of migration has always been a part of his plan. And so going all the way back to Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. And so as his image bearers, those created in his image, cross the earth, glorifying him. In you, Abraham, and through you, all nations will be blessed. And so we see that the movement of the nations has been critical to God's plan in history. By the time we get to the work of the Apostle Paul, we see Paul at Mars Hill. And as we looked at a couple times last night from Acts chapter 17, in verse 26 and 27, you see Paul talking about how God is sovereign over creation. He's sovereign over where people live, and he's sovereign over when they will live. So, and he created from one man every nation of mankind to dwell on the face of the earth, having determined their allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place. And then verse 27, the reason for that, so that they might seek God, yet he's not far from any one of them. And then we talked about the realities in which we find ourselves today in session two. What in the world is God doing? And so we began to talk about the size of the international migrant population, that 3.6% of the world's population is living outside of its country of birth, and that number would be about equivalent to the fifth largest country in the world population-wise. And we also began to talk about how there are people that move freely and willingly, looking for employment, looking for education, better quality of life all over the world. Yet there are some that move because they're forced to flee for whatever reason. Maybe it's disasters, maybe it's war, maybe it's persecution. We talked a little bit about the category of refugees. We also talked a little bit about the category of international students that have come to places across the world, particularly in the United States, and the large numbers of those. We spent some time talking about unreached people groups, and we looked at this chart here that in the United States, there is an estimated number of 186 unreached people groups living within the borders of our country. And of that 186, there are 97, an estimated 97 of those 186 that are considered unengaged unreached people groups, meaning there is no evangelical church planting strategy that is being carried out among those people at this point in time. And so that brings us up to where we are today, and that is session three. Reaching the strangers next door, stories from the field. So I mentioned last night that I was going to just spend this session just telling stories, just sharing various stories from personal experience, from churches where I've served, from others that I know of, in how they have seen God work to engage the nations on the move. And so one of the things I think is important for us to keep in mind is that the church has always been about the telling of the great stories of what God is doing as a part of encouraging us and exhorting us to good works, and also to give glory and praise to God for what he's doing, and to help us think about how now, Lord, shall we live as we move forward. So when Paul, for example, and Barnabas returned from the first missionary journey that's in Acts chapter 13 and 14, they gather together with the church in Antioch, And what you see in verse number 27, when they arrived and gathered the church together, they declared all that God had done with them and how he had opened a door of faith to the Gentiles. And they remained no little time with the disciples. And so this notion of the believers wanting to hear stories, needing to hear stories as a part of our ongoing Great Commission efforts in the world is very critical to who we are as a people. So today, let me share a variety of stories with you. So I will begin by telling you the story of Samuel and Young Cho. So Samuel and Young Cho, Korean couple that migrated to the United States. They are senior adults living at the time in Baltimore, Maryland. And so one day while they are in Baltimore, they find a restaurant and they're having lunch. Their server who comes to them is actually from Nepal. She came to the United States as a refugee. And as they were being served by her in the restaurant, they just began to talk to her about life and about who she is and her life in the States and family and friends back home in other parts of Asia. And soon things begin to transition. They begin to talk about matters of faith. And the next thing you know, this Nepali server begins to show great interest into the things of Christ. And so she begins to talk to Samuel and Young about actually having a Bible study with her and with her family and invites them into her house. And so the Chos go to her home in Baltimore, and it's kind of like Lydia and her household. They get there, and an extended family is living there in the home, and they're very open and very receptive to hearing about the gospel. Well, the Lord begins to move over time as they continue to meet weekly, and people begin to come to faith in this home, this Nepali home. Within a short period of time after that, they have planted a church among this Nepali family in this particular home in Baltimore, Maryland. They begin to teach them scriptures. And soon, the family that makes up this church, they begin to say things such as, wait a minute, we have relatives back home in Nepal and Bhutan and contacts even in parts of India that need to hear this message. How can we get this message to them? And so the Chos begin to lead them and talk to them about some possibilities. And so this small church meeting in this small home in Baltimore, Maryland, organizes over a three-year period of time, three different short-term trips. And they only travel along the social networks that are connected with the people in this new church in Baltimore with family and friends in Nepal, Bhutan, and in India. And over a three-year period of time, they see over 500 people make professions of faith in Christ and three churches planted, one in India and two in Nepal. The question is, how does that happen? How can that even be possible? That you have a Korean couple migrating from South Korea to Baltimore, living life, experiencing life here. You have someone fleeing from a part of Asia coming to the States as a refugee and family members, but yet staying in close contact with family back home. And then over a period of time after they come to faith, only working across the social networks. So they weren't getting online. They weren't calling people up and saying, hey, can you, as this agency, get us into this part of Asia? Hey, you know, as you, this mission organization, can you get us into this refugee camp? No, they were only working the social networks that had been in existence for years among the Nepali community that's now in Baltimore, Maryland. And so what do you see? Well, if you like little cheesy graphics, it kind of looks like this. You have Samuel and Young Cho. They connect with this server, and this server has this extensive social network that extends into a realm where the Chos could never go because of who they were, because of where they were, because they didn't have the relationships. Now, let's stop and ask ourselves a question. Can that happen? I mean, can that actually happen? Because there was no committee organizing this. There was no agency putting this together. No one was reading Dr. J.D. Payne's books on this stuff. And it happened. You know, can that happen? Do we see the possibilities? And the answer is absolutely. Can Koreans in the United States plant churches among Nepalese in the United States, and can that lead to the planting of churches in India and in Nepal? And the answer is yes, but do we see the possibilities? Or is our understanding of missions and Great Commission work, is it too narrow? Is it too much in a very traditional vein and often forgetting about what God is doing, moving people throughout the world? Let me tell you another story. I'll tell you about Mejra. Mejra was the first Bosnian lady that I ever met. So in the United States, the largest Bosnian population is in the St. Louis area. But I wasn't in St. Louis at the time. I was in Louisville, Kentucky. And I walked in one day to a Supercuts to get my hair cut. And I sit down in Mejra's chair, and we begin talking, and I find out she's Bosnian. Now, on unreached people group lists of the world, Bosnians are very much up there as far as unreached peoples. And so I pretty much assume she's probably from an unreached people group in Bosnia. And so we begin to talk, and I find out that she's Muslim, and we're just talking, and I'm asking her questions about Islam and sharing with her about what Christ has done in my life. And I asked her, I said, have you ever read about Isa, the name for Jesus, in the Injil, which is the New Testament? Muslims are encouraged to read about Isa in the New Testament. And she said, no, I haven't read anything about him. And I said, well, you know, he's changed my life. And I began to share my story, my testimony of how he's changed my life, how he could change hers. And I said, would you be interested if I could get you a copy of the Injil in Bosniak? Would you be interested in reading it? And she said, you can get a copy of it in my language, my heart language? I said, yeah. And so she said, I would very much be open to that. So I contacted a friend of mine who was actually working with Bosnians, and I said, hey, can I get a copy of the Bible for this Bosnian lady that I just met? Do we see the opportunities? Do we see the possibilities? Let me tell you a similar story with a gentleman by the name of Rain. So my wife Sarah and I were in New Mexico one time, and I was speaking at a conference there, and I wanted to go to a restaurant that served Native American food. And so we got online, and we found a place, and so we... It was during the week, and it was a little bit early for dinner, but we went out, and so there were very few people in the restaurant at the time, and we go in, and I don't know exactly what to expect, but I'm looking for a great meal of Native American dishes, and our server comes to our table, and he's clearly not Native American, and I said, well, you're not Native American. He said, no. He said, I'm from Pakistan. And I said, what brings you to New Mexico? And so he's taking our order. He's filling, our water glasses and things of that nature. And he said, well, I was adopted. My parents adopted me. Well, I knew that most Pakistanis were not Christian, but would be Muslim. And so I just kind of kept that in mind, and he had to go about his business. He was waiting on other tables. And again, there were not many tables in that restaurant that evening that were occupied. And he comes back, and he takes our order, and he recommends some things, and he's coming back and forth. And the whole time, we're just having this very nice, casual conversation. And I knew that back home in Birmingham, we had members in our church that had adopted children from that part of the world. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll use this as an opportunity to make a connection. I wonder if his parents that adopted him, I wonder if they're Christians. He was raised in Pakistan, but maybe he was adopted by Christian parents. Maybe he's a believer. I don't know. And so he comes back, and I said, well, my wife and I, we're from Birmingham, Alabama, and we've got people in our church family back home, and they've adopted children from from that part of the world where you were born and grew up, and they're Christian. I'm just curious, are your American parents, are they Christians? And he said, oh yes, they're Christians, but they're nominal Christians. They don't attend a church, they don't read the Bible or anything. And so I was never raised in any sort of Christian tradition. I said, I'm guessing you're probably born into a Muslim family. He said, yes, I was born into a Muslim family. And so we were talking a little bit, just again as he's coming back and forth. And so Rain came to us one time, and I said, Rain, I said, well, you know, my wife and I are followers of Jesus, and he's really changed our lives, and we're thankful that we could be here with you tonight. And we just got to share a little bit about our story with him. And I asked him the same question that I asked Mesra, because he came from a Muslim background. I said, I'm just curious. I said, I know your American parents, they didn't teach you about anything about the Bible, about Jesus. I'm just curious, have you ever read anything about him? And he said, well, no, not much. But he said, I would really like to. I've been interested in finding out more about who he is. And I said, let me guess. You probably grew up speaking Urdu. And he said, yes. He's like, how did you know? It's like, most Americans don't know that. It kind of helps when you know people serving in that part of the world. You hear them talk about, now I can't give you one word in Urdu other than the word Urdu. And so, but I knew that most people in Pakistan would be speaking Urdu. And so I said, how about this? I said, Rain, if I can get you a copy of the New Testament that talks about Jesus, and I can kind of tell you where to begin, if I can get you a copy in Urdu, would you be interested and would you read it? And he looked at me, and his eyes got as big as the plates on the table, and he said, you can get a copy for me in Urdu? He said, I would love to have something in my language. So we exchanged contact information. When I got back to Alabama, I found a copy of the Urdu New Testament and sent it to him. Again, do we see the opportunities? Do we see the opportunities with people that are on the move? Let me tell you about this one. So, Birmingham, as you well know, we're no longer the largest city in the state. 10 years ago when I moved there, we were, but we're no longer the largest city of the state. Huntsville has now surpassed us. And the last number I heard, we're not even number two. So we're not the most diverse city, of course, but there is a great deal of ethnic diversity, but they're very small numbers of pockets of people. We have over 100 languages spoken in the Jefferson County, Shelby County public school system. There are at least 90, 95 different nationalities living in the city. And so you have a great deal of diversity, but it's so small, you just kind of don't see it playing out in public. But on in personal levels, you begin to see and experience these things. Well, a church member came to me one time when I was one of the pastors with the church at Brook Hills, and he said, J.D., he said, I've been working with this guy, and we've become friends, and he's from Nepal, and he's just a great guy. We've really hit it off and everything, and been sharing life with him. He said something to me the other day that really surprised me. I said, what was it? Because he knows he's a believer. He shared his faith with him. He said, J.D., this guy told me, he said, my family owns an apartment complex back home in Nepal. Would you be willing to come and spend a month or two in the summer with me? You've been showing such hospitality to me here in Birmingham. Would you be willing to come with me? My family has an apartment. We'll put you up. We'll cover your expenses for meals and lodging. Would you just come and just spend a month or two with me and my family in Nepal? Let you meet my friends, meet my family members. How does that happen? How does that take place where that door of opportunity just opens up? Would you stay with me in Nepal? How about another one? So I had another family to come to me one time, one of our church families, and the wife was an employee at one of the hospitals in Birmingham, and she befriended and connected with a South Asian Indian lady that she worked with, and they became good friends, And her husband and her kids met the South Asian Indian woman and her family and her kids, and they would get together and they would spend time with one another, and over the course of meals and over the course of tea and over the course of coffee would hear opportunities about following Christ. And then one day she comes to this Christian family in Birmingham and she says to them, "We have a family member in India that is getting married soon. Would you be willing to come and be our guests in India and be a part of this wedding?" Now, I don't know if you've ever been to an Indian wedding, but it's not like your typical, hey, 2 hours and let's find the food to eat. I mean, I went to an Indian wedding in the States, and it was about a 3 or 4 hour ordeal. And I'll have to tell you off to the side sometime if you're ever wanting to have a cross-cultural experience. That was amazing. I'll be glad to share it with you. But it basically looked like this. The room was set up kind of like with these chairs. The priest was up here doing the wedding ceremony with the groom and the bride in Sanskrit. You couldn't understand a word he's saying, and every now and then you hear a bell, and every now and then you'd see some incense. But all of the white Americans were like sitting on this side, and we did like what we do at a wedding. You just sit there, and you just stare at the front. And then all the South Asian Indians, they're all, you know, sitting over here, and they're standing over here, and they're standing in the back, and they're standing up here, and they're all talking. And so you get, no one's paying attention to what's going on up here except for these Americans, white Americans are like doing the thing that we always do at a wedding. And then after about an hour and a half, you realize, wait a minute, you know, maybe we need to just mingle and move around. And so a very interesting experience. But here's what she said: "Will you be my wedding guest in India? The wedding ceremony is going to be 3 days long. Would you come and be our guest?" Now think about this. How does that happen? How do you get an invitation like that to be able to become an insider in people's social networks? And can it be possible that you can get into some places of the world that are really, really difficult to get into as a result of being an employee in a hospital in Birmingham, Alabama? Fascinating, fascinating. I'll give you another story from Birmingham. One Saturday, we got several of our church members together, and we were talking about the issue of migration into the city, and we wanted to just go out into the city and see what we could identify, who are the nations living among us. And so what we did was we did a little bit of training with our church members, and then about 40 people on Saturday took about 4 hours of their time. And they went out into the streets of Birmingham. And we had places mapped out where people could go. And so they went into various ethnic minority supermarkets and restaurants and parks where a lot of people would gather, and near apartment complexes and nail salons and just a variety of different places. When we came back after 4 hours, we wrote down on a whiteboard all the different nationalities we encountered, because we had some things. We'd connect with people and, you know, ask them some questions and tell them what we were doing and who we were with, and obviously looking for an opportunity to share Christ. We came back after 4 hours. After 4 hours, we had personally encountered 34 different nationalities. 34 different nationalities, and almost all of those were countries that were primarily comprised of unreached people groups. We met an individual, a lady who was working at a Chinese restaurant, that it was believed that her people group in the United States could only be found in a part of the Dallas-Fort Worth area. She and an entire social network that she was a part of in Birmingham, Alabama, was off of one of the major highways in the city, off of Highway 280. We didn't even know it until we got out and began to meet and talk with people. But here's something that's interesting that happened as a result of that experience. A few weeks later, one of the senior adult ladies that was with us that day, she comes up to me and she says, "Hey, Brother JD, you know, some of us senior adult ladies, we get together and we have, you know, Bible study together and things of that nature. But on that Saturday, we went out, and one of us goes to a particular nail salon. And we got to talking, and one of the ladies said, you know, I think there are some ladies that work in this salon that were from Vietnam. why don't we go into the salon on this Saturday and just sit down and have our nails done and have conversation, find out about people and where they're from and who's here in Birmingham. And so they go to this particular salon, and sure enough, it's owned and operated by a Vietnamese gentleman, and the women that are working there are all from Vietnam. And they do not speak English very well. And so one of these ladies comes up with this genius idea, and they get together, and they go to the owner, and they say to him, because he trusted them, because they were coming in quite often doing their nails, he trusted them, and they said, "Would you be interested if we came in before working hours and we taught your ladies English? We just did English conversation with them to help them improve their English skills so that, you know, as they work with customers." He became so excited. He told these ladies that are part of our church, he said, "I would love for you to come. I'll pay you. I'll pay you to come in and do this." And they said, No. We want to share the love of Christ with you in a very practical way. We want to help these ladies in developing job skills, and we want to be here embracing you in the community and serve you." And so they begin going in before the store opens with these women, beginning to teach them how to improve in their English skills. So how can you do that? Can you do that? Is that even a possibility? I'll tell you about Jay. When I lived in Louisville, Kentucky, there was one day that I was in a small coffee shop with one of my friends. And I had placed an order. I was standing off to the side waiting for the barista to fix my drink. And out of my right ear, I hear someone just yell, "That guy's crazy." Well, you know, it's kind of quiet, and it's like, that's really odd. So the natural reaction is you're going to turn and look. So I turn and look, and there's this young guy who's in his early 20s, and he's standing there, and he's looking at the New York Times magazine, or New York Times rack that's there. And I look at him, and I just walk over to him, and I said, "What is it?" And he said, "That guy's crazy." I said, what do you mean?" He said, "That guy." And I look on the cover of the New York Times, and it's a Palestinian cleric who is leading an uprising and a revolt in the Middle East. And he said, "That guy is from my hometown." He said, "I'm Palestinian." He said, "That guy's from my hometown, and he's leading this, you know, this problematic issue to a heightened level of conflict in this community." He said, "This guy's crazy what he's doing." And so we just start talking. And I said, "Are you waiting to get something to drink?" He said, "Yeah." And I said, "Hey, my friend and I, we're just here in the coffee shop. You want to join us?" And he said, "I'd love to." So he gets his tea, he sits down with us, and we just start talking, hanging out, and we're just talking, sharing life. And it's very natural to begin to talk about matters of faith with a lot of people that migrate, because there are two things that most people, I won't say all, there are two things that most people throughout the world want to talk about. And when you go, they want to talk about politics, they want to talk about religion. But as most people who have grown up in the United States, we have been taught that there are two things that you do not talk about with people, right? You don't talk about politics, and you don't talk about religion. But the world wants to talk about these things. So I decide, okay, I know I'm going to have to get out of my comfort zone a little bit, but this guy is, you know, from Palestine, and so I'm going to step out of my comfort zone. And I said, "Hey, Jay," I said, "so you talked about that cleric. So are you Muslim?" "Oh, yeah." And that just leads into a huge conversation. So we begin to talk to him about how Christ has changed our life. And we asked him, we said, "Hey, are you at this coffee shop that, you know, quite frequently?" He said, "Oh, yeah, I just live down the street. You know," he said, "I come in here all the time." And I said, "Would you be interested if we got together to look at what the New Testament, the NGL, says about this guy, Jesus, that we've been talking about?" And he said, "I'd love to do that." He said, "Let's do it. We'll get together over coffee and tea, and we'll meet here." For the next 6 weeks, we met in that coffee shop with him, with God's word, sharing the gospel, talking with him about Christ. How does that happen? How does that happen? Let me share with you another story. A story about West Africa from New York. A friend of mine has lived in Harlem for many years and is significantly involved in reaching out to West Africans there, church planting there. But that's not where his story started. He actually had been a missionary in West Africa. He was working among a Wolof-speaking people from Senegal. And because of health reasons, he was forced to come to the States and move back to the States. He was living in Texas with his family. And this, I mean, this was many years ago. This was, I'm guessing by now, it's probably 20 years ago, when much of this conversation was not taking place on migration and mission. And so at times he would begin to hear about people moving from West Africa to the States, but he had no real clarity of what he needed to do. And so he began praying and seeking the Lord's guidance. Is my people group, the Wolof speakers, could they be here in the States? Could, you know, we're here, the Lord has brought us home because of health reasons, but can we still do ministry among this people? And so he hears that possibly there is a group of Wolof speakers from Senegal living up in New York in the Harlem area. But he's not certain who's there, how many people are there. The data is difficult to find. And so he gets on a plane and he flies to New York. He gets off the plane and he gets into a taxi, and his taxi cab driver is Senegalese and is a Wolof speaker. No joke. And that leads to he and his family moving to Harlem, right in the heart of the West African community. Now here's where things get even more fascinating. And that is, he told me, he said, J.D., he said, I now have more opportunities to share the gospel in West Africa living in New York than I did when I was living in West Africa. And I said, you're going to have to explain that. What do you mean by that? He said, when I lived in West Africa, I was identified as the missionary. I lived in missionary housing. I rode with missionaries. I was always with missionaries. People saw me. They knew that I was the missionary. But in West Africa, here's what has happened. My family and I have been loving and serving and ministering to these people here that are not believers. But because they stay in contact with family and friends back home, they're always communicating with them. And I travel in and out on short-term trips into and out of West Africa. And they give me gifts to take to family back in West Africa. And here's what they say. Listen to this man. He is a man of God. He is a Bible teacher. You need to hear what he has to say. Now, these are Muslim people telling Muslim people this. You need to hear what this man of God has to say. He's true. He's honest. His integrity is there. He's upright. You need to hear what he has to say. He's carrying these gifts from us to you back home. You need to let him stay in your house. And you need to be his chauffeur while he is in West Africa when he's there. And he said the people in New York have been opening doors for him in West Africa in ways that they never opened when he lived in West Africa. Is that a possibility? Can we do things like that in the world in which the Lord has placed us today? Are these opportunities and are they out there for us? Let me tell you about this story. So we had a church member one time who had come to Birmingham. He was a student at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, working on his degree. And he was hanging out in Starbucks one day. And here's what he's doing. He's in Starbucks, and he's having his devotion time with the Lord. And he's reading about Acts chapter 10, Peter going to Cornelius' house. And he's praying about the possibility, and he'd been thinking about it for a long time, about the possibility of moving to the Middle East to work among the Saudis. And so he's sitting there and he's praying, God, would you give me courage? Would you give me faith? Would you give me courage? Give me strength to trust in you to go to the Middle East. And he looks up and he looks across the room in Starbucks and he sees four college students, looks like college students, sitting around this table. And based on just their facial features and their skin tones and hair and things of that nature, they looked like they were probably from someplace in the Middle East. And at that moment, Gary tells this story and he says, I just sensed that the Lord was leading me to go over and just introduce myself to these guys. And I had to ask myself a question. If I was willing to trust God to give me the courage and the strength and the faith to go to the Middle East, should I not be willing to trust him to give me that to get across this room? You know, with my latte in hand. And so he walks over, and they got these stacks of books because they're there studying at this table. And he begins to talk to them. And he says, hey, I'm a student here. I'm studying architecture. Are you all students? And they say, yeah, we're all students. And he says, hi, my name's Gary. He said, you know, what's your name? And my name's Muhammad.
My name's Muhammad. And I can't remember the last guy's name, so we'll just call him Joe. My name's Joe. And so yeah, you got like three Muhammads and a Joe. And if you get, he says, hey, are you students here in the city? And they say, yeah. And they tell him what university he's with. And he said, where's your country of birth? Where did you come from? They said, we're from Saudi Arabia. Of course you are. Of course you are. That day, they invited him to sit down. And that day began a relationship with these four guys that continued for months. They were always at Starbucks hanging out. Starbucks would close, and they would sit outside in the chairs underneath the awning till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, just socializing, hanging out. They were always together, hanging out, having coffee and tea. They were playing soccer together. They were watching movies together. Gary was, you know, sharing meals with them. And Gary was, from the very moment he met them, he was raising the flag, sharing Christ with them, talking to them about Christ. And Gary was soon to be baptized into our church's fellowship. And so he tells Muhammad, and Joe the day that he's going to be baptized, and he invites them to come. And so he's backstage waiting to be baptized, and he looks out, and he doesn't see them. And so he gets on the phone, he sends them a text, he says, where are you? We're about to be baptized. And they write back, and they said, oh, we're sorry, Gary, you know, because not very time-oriented, more relational-oriented. We're just hanging out down here at Starbucks, but we'll be there. You know, a lot of places throughout the world, they're not as time-conscious as we are. It's kind of like if Payne doesn't shut up in 4 minutes, then we're just going to get up and walk out of the room and have our coffee because he's supposed to be done at 45, you know, after the hour. You know, a lot of parts of the world, more relational. So they show up. Of course, they miss his baptism, but that was the first worship gathering that they were ever a part of, and the gospel was made so clear that day. They come up to Gary afterwards and they say, oh, Gary, we're so sorry we missed your baptism, but the next time you get baptized, let us know, we'll be on time. One of the guys comes to Gary and he says, Gary, he said, if Jesus is really the way, the truth, and the life that you say that he is, then I want to follow him. And Gary said to Muhammad, he said, do you understand, Muhammad, what this could potentially mean for you when you return home to Saudi Arabia? And he said, if Jesus is really who you say he is and who you've taught us from the scriptures, then I'm willing to give my life for him. And then he said this, you have been so gracious and kind over the past 2 semesters, showing me and my friends hospitality and just befriending us, you know, as an American here. Would you be willing to come and spend a couple of weeks with me in Saudi Arabia this summer and meet my family and meet my friends and go hang out at our coffee shops and play our, you know, sports games? Would you be willing to come? You just get there. We'll take care of everything. How does that happen? What if one possibility of the way that we do short-term trips and even mid-term and long-term trips in the future, what if it's based on what we're doing in our own backyard? Do we see the possibilities of what the Lord is doing and moving the nations around the world? You know, so many times we find ourselves trying to knock on doors that are really difficult to open. But what if we're doing ministry in our backyard and the Lord is opening doors and is going to take us to other parts of the world in ways we couldn't predict or script? I'll give you one last story before our break. I several years ago, was on a video conference call with a missionary who was in Yemen. And we were talking about what was going on. Again, this was several years ago. The conflict was really beginning to heat up at the time, and the problems were taking place there, and he and his family were probably going to have to leave. And he said, J.D., I don't think we're going to be able to stay in country that much longer. This is when I was pastoring at the time. He said, we're probably going to have to leave. He said, even here where we are, it is so difficult to even connect with the people of Yemen. We're always being watched. We always have to change our routine. We cannot do anything the same way, our same, you know, daily, you know, routes and activities. We can't do the same thing each day. We come into our apartment. We basically have to keep our blinds closed. We can't really get out. All these problems are coming up. We're having a difficult time even just connecting with the Yemeni people. We may have to leave Yemen. Now, fast forward a few months later, and I find myself in a very interesting situation. I find myself sitting in a Yemeni mosque. And what's fascinating is that I'm there in this Yemeni mosque for an hour and a half, and I'm sitting in the corner of a room, and there are nine men around me, all in their full, attire, full garb. And for an hour and a half, I'm sharing the gospel with them, and they're asking questions, and they're sharing about Islam with me, and I'm asking questions. And at the end of our time, after an hour and a half, just great interaction, great conversation, myself and my host and the guy that's with me, we get up to leave, and as we're going to get our shoes to put our shoes on, one of the Yemeni men comes over to me, and his beard is dyed in henna. He's made the Hajj, the pilgrimage, fully dressed, broken English. He only has known me for an hour and a half, and he knows we completely disagree on matters of faith and who Christ is. Through broken English, about 8:30 at night, comes over to me, and he says this, "You come to my home for dinner?" Now, I was in a Yemeni mosque when that happened. A few months before, I was talking to a person living in Yemen and the difficulties he was having sharing the gospel, and yet I was invited into a Yemeni man's home and had the opportunity to have an hour and a half conversation. Oh, I left out an important detail in that story. I wasn't in Yemen. I was in Detroit. The largest Yemeni population in the country is in the greater Detroit area, particularly around Hamtramck area. And we had gone into this part of Dearborn, this part of Hamtramck, and it was wide open for opportunities to share the gospel and talk with people from Yemen. And as we drove away that night, I couldn't help think, but how easy was that? That in an hour and a half, 2 hours, out of Birmingham Airport, could be in Detroit among a very large population of Yemeni people who we knew of no known believers. 12,000 at that time, no known believers. Now, let me make this disclaimer before I end that I did on first session, and that is, by far, the greatest needs for the gospel, for church planting, for making disciples is outside of the United States. It's outside of the traditionally Western parts of the world, where particularly access is very limited. Many people of the world, they're not going to migrate. They stay where they are. And so I want you to understand that for me and for all of us, our highest priority should be in other parts of the world. But again, what are we overlooking? Are we being wise kingdom stewards in light of the fact that God oversees where they live and when they live, and he moves people into our neighborhoods? And sometimes it's as easy as walking into a mosque on a Tuesday night and being greeted by the imams and sitting down with water and talking for an hour and a half and being able to share the gospel and being invited into someone's home. Sometimes it's as easy as that. And who knows where that's going to take us that may open up opportunities in other parts of the world. And I I was just shocked at just what was happening where a few months earlier, someone was living in country and had very, very limited access to talk to the people about Christ. I wasn't in the country, and I was talking to Yemeni people who were in the United States. All these stories I've thrown out to you, I shared with you, and I could go on. There are others that I share and I write about in Strangers Next Door. But I do this to say, I want to encourage us. I want us to think through some of the opportunities that the Lord gives us, through some just very natural channels of conversation and interaction, and realize that we are at a time, because so much of the movement of the nations is happening, we're at a time whereby we may find ourselves planting churches in the other parts of the world that we never thought we could get into, but it was only through the connections here. Because if you begin to connect with people and you become a part of their social networks, you become an insider, and you're no longer seen as an outsider. And oftentimes when we go into other parts of the world, we're trying to find ways to get into difficult situations, and we're oftentimes shunned because we're outsiders. But what if someone from there over here embraces us and we become an insider, and they begin to open doors as that person of peace on the other side of the world for us to be insiders? So,
Brother, I think we're out of time, so I'll turn it over to you.
Yep, take 10 minutes or so.